Welcome to Conversations for a Brave New World with Donna, Sonia and Cliff, where we bring you a global, national and local focus on gender, sexuality and feminism.
Hi, I'm Donna Bridges, Associate Professor of Sociology at Charles Sturt University. And I'm joined today by two experts in the area of violence against women. You might remember them from last November when they came together here at Conversations for a Brave New World during the 16 days of activism. They are Rachel Hogg and Paula Cahill. Paula is a generalist counsellor at the Central West Women's Health Centre. Paula works extensively with women experiencing or recovering from domestic violence and trauma and sexual assault. And you can find out more about Paula at www.cwwhc.org.au. We also have Dr. Rachel Hogg, who's a senior lecturer at the School of Psychology at CSU and a member of our very own Gender and Feminist Studies Network. So, and you can find out more about Rachel on the School of Psychology website or at the Gender Network website for CSU. So today we're talking to Paula and Rachel about violence against women in rural Australia. So my first question is for Rachel. Rachel, what specific challenges do rural women face in advocating for gender justice that urban women might not experience?
Thanks so much, Donna. It's fantastic to be with you both. And I think this is a really important question that we are starting with today to consider. And it's something that builds on the conversation that we started last year. So one of the things that gets spoken about quite a lot now, and I think it's generally becoming quite well known, that regional and rural women experience higher rates of domestic violence than their more urban counterparts. So we know that the starting gates are different for regional and rural women when it comes to advocating for gender justice. Those gender divides are often more evident in regional and rural contexts for a whole range of different economic and social and even psychological reasons. So there are more challenges in rural contexts. That is certainly true. The process of striving for justice can also look a little bit different in a regional context. And one of the reasons for this, perhaps, and I'm going to jump straight into some quite political territory to begin with, if you were to wander the streets of either Sydney or maybe your local town, such as Bathurst, for example, and ask people if they value fairness and justice, the average Australian is going to say yes, absolutely. If you ask these same people, do you support gender equity, you tend to see much more mixed kinds of responses. Part of the reason for this is that we've been fed this idea that this is a zero-sum game, so that as some people are gaining, as women are gaining, others, men in particular, are losing something. And this kind of mentality has pervaded a lot of our political discourse. It's pervaded a lot of our media discourse in this space as well. But if we return to the question of fairness, for the most part, humans intrinsically understand and value fairness and justice. And I would say that this is a particular value in rural and regional areas. So I think there's a lot of challenge in these contexts, but I also think there's some opportunity. But in regional contexts especially, there is a whole suite of factors that impact on gender justice. And one of the most obvious ones in a regional context, and particularly in rural contexts, is the challenges associated with climate-related change and climate-related disasters. And this has all kinds of implications for the physical health of people in these communities, including in relation to violence. And we also know that as disaster events increasingly occur, and they do tend to have quite a disproportionate effect on regional and rural Australia, rates of domestic violence also increase. If we really want to think about what gender justice looks like in a rural and regional context, we actually really need to be thinking about the environment.
That's an interesting connection, and not many people would put that together, I don't think. We do know that during times of stress, domestic violence will increase. And that's any kind of stress, isn't it, Paula? That's like any kind of stress occurring outside of the family or within the family. And with climate change and other issues, it's certainly clear that rural women in Australia do experience higher rates of domestic violence. I have heard that there's fewer support services as well. So what systemic kind of changes are needed to address this, Paula?
An individual's life is shaped first and foremost by biology. So that includes whether you're male or female, but it also includes your personality, whether you're introverted or extroverted, whether you have born with a disability or could be your culture that you're born into as well. And the colour of your skin is going to impact on your life opportunities as well that are out of our control. And then we think about the family unit and whether there's strong attachment or attachment issues. And we know what a disrupting influence domestic violence and stress has on babies' attachments to their families and the level of care they're able to access. And that's also really impacted by social inequality and things like the environment and experience of disaster and trauma. So we have that development happening in a family system, and then we have that development happening in an extended family and a community. So it includes things like influences of churches and the education level people that are able to access, and whether or not how that intersects with, you know, their experience of disability or trauma or acceptance of education or engagement in education. And so I guess that has an influence. And then we think about some of the wider things, like, you know, you're in a country and you're in a political system and you're in a society and you're in an era. So all of those things have an influence on how we develop as humans and the experiences that we can access and the impact of that access on our lives and development and functioning. So in terms of how we think about some of these things, how do we think about systems that support families to be healthy family units for that, so that they have the same sorts of opportunities and participation?
So it seems like you're saying, Paula, that inequality breeds violence.
Absolutely.
So would you say there's more inequality in rural areas?
Absolutely. You know, if you go to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, you can have a look at people's incomes and you can see that in rural areas, people have lower incomes. There's no two ways about that. And then if you cut those statistics a bit more, there's gender differences in that. And there's those differences can also be exacerbated by access to education and access to health services and all of those other things that are more difficult in rural areas. So I guess in terms of systemic changes, I think you're absolutely right in thinking about the impact of the environment. We know that in societies that have better social cohesion, less health problems, less problems with violence, they have higher social cohesion, they have less economic inequality. So in terms of really big systems and really big structures, it's multi-layered and multifaceted, but that growing inequality, a lot of it comes down to access to natural resources and the environment, and it also comes down to inequality in societies.
In rural areas at the moment, particularly our own regions, what initiatives do you think we've got in place at the moment that are working?
Well, there obviously are things that are starting to work, because if I think about Bathurst that I moved to when I was a young woman, it's changing all the time. But I have a lot of hope about the future. So I think some of the things that are working in rural communities are that women are getting equal participation in, particularly in professions that mean that there is influence. So one of the things that has given me a lot of hope is a recent statistic that women are in equal numbers in the legal profession. And so what I've noticed is a shift in the way that we think about domestic violence and domestic violence laws and the implementation of that. I mean, when I was growing up in a country town, you never heard of a female police officer. So there are things that are starting to change.
It's really surprising me that you're both talking so big picture. Like these are the very wide contextual areas. And I guess I was expecting you to say, well, these services, this service, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about big picture. So I find that really interesting. So my next question is quite influenced by that. Rachel, what's the role in political decisions in rural Australia?
The million-dollar question. There's a couple of different ways of thinking about political decision-making and the influence, particularly in regional and rural areas, and particularly for women. Politicians create policy, but they do something else as well as that, and that is they set the cultural standard. There's the policy piece, and the other is culture. The saying the personal is political has been around for a long time, and I think it's never been truer in some respects than as we look at the demographics of our political constituents now. So the behaviour and attitudes of politicians, as well as their image curation, both reflects the culture and it also shapes and reinforces the dominant standards. So politicians try to appeal to the public in a way that they think will resonate, but the way that they create themselves also sets a particular standard. And I'm thinking about this in terms of the very masculine, historically very masculine standards that have been upheld in political culture, both in terms of the fact that politics in Australia has historically always been almost exclusively the purview of men, but also that a particular type of male is often held up in that space. And, you know, we can see this when we look at politicians as brands, you know, Bob Hawke having a beer with the best of them, fierce upbringing as an indicator of his relatability. Scott, how good is Australia? Morrison was raised in quite inner city elite circumstances, but desperately curated the image of himself as a laid back larrikin. So we have a particular brand of masculinity that is curated for the Australian public. And at the same time, we have a paucity of female leaders. We have a culture that normalizes violence and abuse towards female politicians because of their general tendency to view any member of the elite as less than human. Women in governing bodies are experiencing gender-based violence on a pretty frightening scale in this country. And we saw when Hillary Clinton ran for office, the word ambition was cast around as a slur. It was not said as a, you know, reflection on her merits or her desire to change the country. And the reason for that is because it is a norm violation. Women are perceived as threatening and as stepping outside of traditional feminine norms when they engage in a way that we perceive as being ambitious. There was a European MP who reported receiving over 500 rape threats on Twitter over 4 days. And then right after Kamala Harris was elected as the first female VP of the US and also the first woman of colour to hold that role, the Telegraph in the UK ran a headline, "Why Kamala Harris is the modern beauty icon the world needs." Now, you might think, and you would be correct in thinking, that I've strayed a little from your original question, but the route back to this is to say that we have seen over and over again, the political decision making and policies that affect women are made more effectively when women are involved in the decision making. And if we do not address the political culture and the ways in which women are kept out of politics, either directly or indirectly, it makes it much harder for us to consider decision making in this space.
Something that's really been a bit surprising is the number of women that are supporting some of these policies that actually act against their best interests. So what do you make of that, Rachel?
My instinctual response to your question, Paula, is that one of the things that is incredibly hard to shake free from as a woman is what young women describe now as pick-me culture. And what pick-me culture is basically a way of describing all of the different ways in which women are celebrated and rewarded for sacrificing something, most often their freedom. And the pathway to male approval is quite difficult to extract yourself from. And what I'm seeing in the sort of trad wife, traditional wife community that obviously segues with MAGA and a lot of the women who have supported Trump is that they feel a sense of restoration and value in being told to get back into the kitchen. This return to traditional gender roles as where you have a man who is a protector, and Donald Trump, that has been quoted on the record in the last 6 months on multiple occasions, saying that nobody protects women better than he protects women. He's really leaning into that very traditional masculine role that so many young men have been raised to think is where their worth lies. And I think that some of those women have never stepped out of a traditional gender role, but they have felt as though traditional gender roles somehow, you know, were a mark of shame, that, you know, if you're not working or if you're not engaging in some of the more feminist seeming spheres of life, that you're just a quotes housewife and that that's a bit of a mark against you. So I think that's a factor. I think there's another segment, and I think that these are more younger career women who are absolutely exhausted trying to manage childcare, husband care, all kinds of care roles, and they don't know how to keep doing that. Clementine Ford has talked about this in her book, Don't, The Case Against Marriage, where she talks about the ways in which feminists have been blamed for decreasing rates of marriage. The more obvious answer is perhaps that women are not finding marriage satisfying, or they're not finding certain aspects of traditional gender roles satisfying.
So talking about Trump, Paula, do you see any of the gender equity issues, any of the rejection of DEI policy creeping in rural areas in Australia that is coming from overseas politics?
You know, it's really interesting how much airtime Trump gets in Australia, for a start. Like, this is always the first or second news item, you know, every time in Australia that, you know, you Google search browser, it comes up with an article about what Trump's done now, and it is quite overwhelming, and we seem to be talking about it a lot in Australia. But I guess also, you know, when I read, and I shouldn't, comments section on various things about Dutton and some of the things that I've heard him saying that seem to be very similar to what we've heard from really conservative side of government in America, is you see a lot of support for that return to traditional values, or I think people are frightened at the moment, and there is a lot of worry about the cost of living and the impact of environmental disasters, and people are struggling. They look very simple solutions, but they absolutely mean that not everyone gets the same access.
It was only in 2010 in Australia, in Queensland, that a 19-year-old woman stood trial in Cairns for the crime of having an abortion. We are not quite so far away from America as we might like to think. Thinking about some of the legal reforms that have taken place over time, particularly court-based legislation, you know, Virginia Trioli has written about the ways in which victims of sexual crimes generally experience two assaults. The first assault by the perpetrator and the second at the hands of the courts. And the objectification of women in political circles that I spoke about earlier is something that has occurred in a much, much more frightening way in legal proceedings around some of the crimes that relate to domestic violence and particularly to sexual assault, being to make it irrelevant whether a victim struggled or sustained injury during an assault, restricting the admissibility of a woman's sexual history when prosecuting or investigating a case, you know, introducing alternative arrangements for giving evidence, such as closed circuit TV, increasing the maximum penalty for a rape conviction to 25 years. So we've come a long way, but I'm really nervous sometimes about talking about where we're at right now. And one of the things that's often used to prevent progress is to highlight the progress that has already occurred. And there is this tendency to expect, you know, come on, like, let's be grateful for what's already happened. First of all, we are grateful for that. But second of all, we are not quite as liberated right now in this, you know, very woke modern society that we're evidently living in as we would like to think we are.
Now, I was going to ask you both what gives you hope, but after what Rachel just said about maybe we shouldn't celebrate too much. But
it's given me hope that we're having these conversations. It gives me a lot of hope when I talk to my daughters about their understanding of these issues and their body autonomy and, you know, and the young women that are in their circle. I have a lot of hope for the future. I think there is a lot more conversation about these. We've got words to use for a start. We're actually seeing laws that are imperfect, but they're starting to be developed and passed and prosecuted. So things that are used to be elephants under the carpet that are coming out. So I think that's a really positive thing. We've seen Australia have discussions about gender and about gender equity and about diversity. So there are those conversations happening and support for that community. Think about, again, being a young woman and some of the changes. There are lots of positives, but when you see again what's happened in America and a lot of those things being wound back so quickly, we always have to be vigilant. We can never, never stop our fight.
Something that gives me hope is that we are increasingly celebrating achievements for young women that do not involve relinquishing their freedom. And I might sound a little cynical saying that, but in the aftermath of the American election results, many of us would have seen the Your Body, My Choice narrative bursting around social media with young men, some young men openly bragging about what they saw as a moment of heightened control from this point onwards for them when it comes to women and women's bodies. And then in the backlash to that, we saw the 4B movement, the celibacy culture of, you know, no dating, no marrying men, no having sex with men, no children with men, etc., as kind of a response to that. That makes me sad, but I'm seeing increasingly young people not treating relationships as something that is a marker of their success and their worth in the world. And I think that's a really critical thing, because relationships are the thing that make the world go round, but not relationships that cause you incredible emotional and physical and often psychological pain.
Thank you both. So thank you, Rachel, and thank you, Paula.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you,
ladies.
I'm now joined by my colleagues, Cliff and Sonia. Hi, Cliff and Sonia. And we've been listening to Rachel Hogg and Paula Cahill. And one of the things that really struck me about what Rachel was saying right at the very beginning was that country people, people in rural areas, really value fairness. And yet, gender equity is not considered fair. What did you think of that?
Well, I think it's one of those situations where you hear about fairness from the get-go as part of being Australian cultures. But at the same time, I think there is also a perception about who's allowed within what roles and what fairness is within those roles. So it's this whole idea about maybe sticking to your lane, and you can, you know, be fair within your lane, but you're not allowed to cross lanes, or you're not allowed to do something that challenges. And in some ways, it also reminds me of this whole idea about tall poppy. I think Australia sometimes can be a land of many contradictions, where we value fairness, but then we still cut down the tall poppy that's worked really hard to get there. So I wonder whether fairness is gendered in that way based on the roles or context of the person.
And one of the things both of our speakers talked about was the big picture. So we had concerns around climate change, concerns around poverty, access to education, and so on. But both of them talked about a political environment. We see our politicians co-opting the idea of fairness as well. And yet when we watch them in Parliament, or we hear what they're saying in the media, they're not fair at all. They're not fair about women's rights. They're not fair about Indigenous people's rights. And they can be quite toxic and dysfunctional in their gender relations.
Yeah, I think that concept of fairness is actually really interesting from an economic perspective. Keeping things status quo is probably a great idea because, you know, you understand it, you can work within the limits, and maybe things function more economically if they just stay the same as they've ever been, and people can take advantage of those systems to manipulate to what's always been known and well supported. So when you start challenging those systems, I think you create instability, which can cost money to the government in lots of different ways. And so for things to change, there's always going to be a greater economic burden at the beginning, at least, until people get used to it, until the system resettles and realigns itself, if it ever does.
And I think it's an interesting point, because I don't know if you'll ever achieve that in our generation, Sonia. I call me cynical, but this whole idea about the system needing to change, we're already seeing arguments about, oh, she only got that role because she's a woman. You know, we're seeing arguments about, oh, she's a minority quota, what would she know? So we've normalized these explanations in some ways, and I feel as minority groups, I think we also internalize them sometimes in some ways too. Hopefully future generations might have it better. My hope for, you know, the impact of International Women's Day is really about how do we look at women in the future, and how do we expand this notion to include not just a certain kind of woman, and you know, be it white, be it able-bodied, but also be it a certain style of woman. We expect a woman to be pedantically beautiful. We have those imaginaries about softer tendencies, about what qualifies to be a woman, about well-dressed. And I'm thinking about, what's her name, Sheila from Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, you know, the really rough bogan woman. And how do we support their rights too? And all these other notions of how you can be a woman in the world, about trans women, people of color, women of color. Because yes, if the systems are not working for the norm, given women are 50% of the population, how is it ever going to work for women who are a smaller percentage of that 50%?
Well, thank you, Sonia and Cliff, for being with me today and talking about International Women's Day. It is most definitely a complex and ongoing issue. And the discussion about fairness, the concept of fairness, is something I think that we could all be thinking about. And if you want to hear more about women in rural areas on International Women's Day, please join us on the 7th of March at 12:30 online. Contact Donna at dbridges@csu.edu.au, and I will give you a link. Join us for a seminar with Margaret Alston, the leading voice on gender and rurality in Australia.
Thank you for listening. This show is brought to you by the Gender Network. To get involved or find out more, simply Google the Gender Network at Charles Sturt.